I liked to pry off the back of a radio and look at the parts inside, trying to see how they interacted. He took apart the cuckoo clock in the kitchen, the one that never worked, and he realigned the gears by intuition. He closed it up, and the birds started trilling, on the hour. When he was in grade school, one of Mark's mom's friends gave him a dusty green book called Using Electronics. It was published back in the 1950s, and it came from a library that was selling off its obsolete books at garage sale prices. Armed with Using Electronics, he headed for Radio Shack. He wanted the parts to build a crystal radio. He asked the sales clerk for a condenser and for a crystal diode. The clerk looked at him like he was nuts. The vocabulary had changed since the 1950s, when his guidebook had been published. What Mark needed, in the 1970s vernacular, was a capacitor and a 1N34A germanium diode. That's the thing about electronics. The words might change, but the principles don't. Mark was learning to think like an engineer, breaking things down, seeing how they interact. He was approaching everything in the world, radios, cuckoo clocks, model ships, in the same way, as the sum of its parts, always reducing a system to its components, then envisioning how each unit fits together. There's an unassailable logic to this, a truth about how physical objects behave. After school, in the afternoons, Mark would go down to A&S to wait for his mother to get off work. He hung out at the store's electronics department, acquainting himself with the first generation of home computers. A whole universe was on display, everything from the Apple II to the Timex Sinclair. To Mark, each had a personality. The Apple was a rich kid, aloof and inaccessible. The Commodore was scrappy, but limited. But the TRS-80 was just like Mark. It was a smart little machine, elegant and able to do everything the richer ones could. The word Mark used to describe the TRS-80 was suave. You couldn't get a TRS-80 at A&S. The computer's initials stood for Tandy Radio Shack, that mecca of capacitors and diodes and crystal chips and breadboards for mapping out circuits. You couldn't get it at A&S, where his mom had a discount. But that's the computer he wanted. So his parents bought it for him for Christmas. From the beginning, Mark saw himself as a scientist, and his computer was his most important tool. It was his probe, his means of connecting to systems that he wanted to examine. He did the electronic bulletin board scene, even used the ludicrous handle of Il Duque, after being impressed by a television program about the powerful Italian dictator. The best thing about bulletin boards was the clues the files contained, clues about how to connect to the biggest, most complex system there was, the phone system. The files were tantalizing to a nascent hacker, because you knew that some of the mumbo-jumbo in them had to be true. They were written by hackers who had culled kernels of information from dumpster dives. The information, usually no good to them, was evidence of their exploits, and what better way to take credit than to type it up and post it for all to see. Other files taught Mark a new phrase, social engineering. Social engineering means tricking people into giving you information over the phone, usually by pretending you're someone they'd want to talk to. Because, as everyone knows, the best information comes from people, not computers. The people most likely to give out information about how the phone system works are the helpful staffers in the phone company's own business office. The public calls all day with questions, legitimate questions about their bills and their service. The office also handles calls from field workers, the guys stuck up on a telephone pole, the guys who make sure that each customer's phone line works. The business office staff is used to giving out detailed information, politely. Mark started connecting through the business office. Of course, he couldn't go there physically because everyone would see that he was in junior high school and obviously not a lineman at all. So he went to a payphone down the block from his house one afternoon, and from there, dialed the business office. The ambient street sounds only supported his claim that he was up on a pole. A woman answered, "Business office?" Mark said, "Hi, I'm calling from the Repair Service Bureau. My name is Joe Leinerman, and I don't have a directory handy, and I need a number for line assignment." Who wouldn't trust a voice as deep as that? The woman gave him the phone number for the line assignment office. So Mark immediately called line assignment and told the voice at the other end that he needed a cable and pair number for his own telephone number. Dutifully, the voice at the other end read off two long hyphenated numbers that designate specific wires that lead into and out of the Abian household. Think of the pair as a tributary and the cable as the river, all of it flowing into the phone network. The numbers designating a specific cable and pair are simply one unit of information. But if you amass more units, you can start to understand how the system's components fit together. If you can call someone out of the blue, and she helpfully tells you the secret numbers that New York Telephone uses to identify someone's phone service, what won't she tell you? Mark is patient. and he is a scientist. Nearly every day he called back and tried to compile more units of information. He learned that the business office has access to a computer system known as ICRIS, which stands for the Integrated Customer Record Information System. They have to be able to use that to field customers' billing inquiries. From there, he learned about LDMCs and Premise and Premlac and LMOS, all acronyms for systems that administer and map the sprawling telephone network. In time, Mark learned how the pairs that run into your house are connected to cables and how cables are connected to trunks and how all of it is controlled by the switch. Mark the scientist didn't read this in a file somewhere. He learned it through trial and error, through theory and experimentation. The knowledge he assembled is as rock solid as anyone outside of New York Telephone could hope to have. When he was in the system, he had this uncanny sense of the architecture, as if he were physically inside, a sightseer in a cathedral. Mark the teacher needed to share the knowledge that Mark the scientist accumulated. The usual bulletin boards were a bore. It was pointless crowing to wannabe hackers, kids who just follow a recipe for hacking without understanding why you include certain ingredients. Messages posted on bulletin boards are stripped of inflection and facial expressions and can hit a reader full in the face. The ideas and words are not softened by the physical signals that a speaker uses to convey that he's trying to be funny or silly or just plain honest. If you've read it all before, if you know more than the average kid, then scrolling through screen after screen of adolescent ramblings and posturings can be, well, annoying. Mark was looking for a more educated audience. And one day, he got a promising phone number and password from a Florida hacker named CompuFreak. Catch-22. That was the name of the elite, super-secure bulletin board that belonged to the phone number and password. The board operated in Massachusetts, and it was rumored to be a hangout for members of the most notorious gang in cyberspace. Mark had stumbled into the clubhouse of the Legion of Doom. The Legion's founder, Lex Luthor, was so well known in the underground that his face could appear on dollar bills. Lex expropriated the gang's name from a band of arch-criminals that plagued Superman on the Saturday cartoon shows. It was a sign of the times that Lex Luthor was a child of the small screen, more familiar with the cartoon show than with the comic book. Catch-22 was a sneaky board. It had Lex Luthor's patented big business computer response. In other words, when you called it, it would appear as if you had dialed into a huge mainframe. Enter class would appear on the screen. The only acceptable response would be to type VAXB. If you typed anything else, the system would disconnect you. Cool, huh? The password was changed by word of mouth every few months. Another thing Lex Luthor insisted on was that no one would post codes, which are pilfered calling card numbers. That sort of petty crime was beneath LOD and offended the sensibilities of many members.
Mark logged in,
using the password CompuFreak gave him. He quickly moved to the freak part of the board, the place where hackers discuss technical intricacies of the phone numbers they're trying to hack. Mark took one look and practically laughed. Here was the vaunted Legion of Doom, and they had nothing better to post than a few tired telco files that had already made the rounds? He started posting. He explained one acronym, then another. The thing that immediately set his postings apart from everyone else's was that his were so obviously correct. Here was a guy who appeared to understand the whole system, central office to junction box, and every multiplexer in between. Word spread to Lex Luthor himself. Check out this new dude, the telco wizard, Fiber Optic. Where did he come from? How does one become a member of LOD? It wasn't like you had to prick your finger and swap blood with Lex's protege, Eric Bloodaxe, or anything.
Gang members on the electronic frontier
don't live in the same states, wouldn't recognize each other if they were standing shoulder to shoulder on a bus. In fact, Mark swears he never spoke to Bloodaxe before joining LOD. But the boy Bloodaxe remembers it. The encounter occurred like this. One day, down in Texas, where he was a college student, Bloodaxe noticed that Mark had started signing his postings, Fiber Optic, of the LOD. And Bloodaxe thought, who was this kid? He immediately phoned North.
Hi. Is this Mark?
Yeah.
This is Chris, Eric Bloodaxe,
said Bloodaxe, whose real name was Chris Goggins.
Why in the hell are you signing your name LOD? You're not in LOD.
Mark thought for a second and then said solidly, I'm in LOD.
No one is in LOD unless we all vote on it,
corrected Chris, who explained the rules. A unanimous vote is necessary. Then for some reason, the tone of the conversation shifted to what both teenagers really cared about. Hacking the phone company. And Chris realized that Mark really did know as much as people had been saying. Maybe more. This guy was good. The actual vote came a few weeks later. Mark was in. Just like any schoolyard pack of boys born in the shadow of the Dirty Dozen, Hogan's Heroes, and Mission Impossible, the LOD members all fancied themselves specialists in some dark art. One kid might know how to make a wicked blue box, a device cobbled together from top-secret Radio Shack parts that simulated the tones of coins dropping into a payphone. Another might be an expert in programming BASIC. And Mark? He could trace the route of a phone call from New York to Paris, recalling in loving technobabble each photonic stop. He could describe, in detail, the different kinds of computers that run different aspects of the phone company's business. He knew the meaning of the phone system's very English-language-mangling acronym MISAR, Cosmos, SAG, LMOS. He could explain it to anyone. Indeed, he loved to, in eye-glazing, brain-fogging, soporific detail. And he had just turned 17. To tell the truth, a few members got a little sick of the new prodigy. He was brash and had what some out-of-state members recognized as a New York attitude. He didn't give a rat's ass who thought so. He seemed to revel in belittling, blustery hackers who posted misinformation. He loved nothing better than trapping some nitwit who thought Cosmos was some double-secret key to the phone company kingdom. Duh. The name sure sounds important, doesn't it? People were starting to notice. Like Chris. One day, he and a friend, Doctor Who, were hanging out on a hot bulletin board called the Phoenix Project. Who did they run across but fiber optic of the LOD, eviscerating some poor pretender? And this was what Chris thought about Mark. A real, arrogant, smart-ass punk.
3. It's a hot July day, nighttime already, when Eli cruises up to Mark's house in his black Supra. As Mark comes down off the stoop, before he even gets in the car, it's clear he looks nothing like his mega-bass voice would lead you to believe. He's as thin and pale as the underside of an index finger, and has otter-sleek black hair, meticulously clipped and combed. He styles it himself, doesn't trust a barber to preserve the precise geometric layering. His jeans look like they're just about John Candy size, so they're beyond baggy on Mark, cinched with a thick belt and pooling over his shoes. His shirt is clean and pressed. His pants are clean and rumpled. His hair is clean and shiny. He gives off a good smell as he gets into the car, a fresh soapy fragrance that fills the space and makes the car owner self-conscious about all the crumbs on the floor and all the dust motes on the dashboard. Eli says Paul is hanging out at the Continental, an outdoor strip of stores at 71st and Continental Boulevard, so they drive over there and pick him up. And now, of course, the evening's main activities can commence. You might call it hanging out. Eli calls it the mission. Maybe they barely know one another, but already they've got a bond. Imagine meeting the only other two people in the world who think exactly like you, who have totally the same goals in life, who would rather hack into the phone company computer than do anything else you could suggest. And they live in Queens. Maybe it is a mission. They cut across the borough and end up at Eli's house in Jamaica. They don't see his mom, even though she should be home from her job as a receptionist by now, so they don't have to endure the exquisite embarrassment of encountering her, and worse, maybe having to say hello, before they get to the privacy of Eli's room. Eli's dad is a cook, and his parents don't get along.
A lot of people think they might get divorced.
Eli's computer is set up in his bedroom, a room that screams,
"Teenage boy lives here,"
with a life-size poster of a bikini-clad model on the closet door, a white cordless phone, a second desk phone with two lines, a TV, and cable box. Eli has a York cassette recorder, a Spectron telephone speaker amplifier, and a shoebox containing 120 floppy disks. The bed is made, the dresser is dusted, the clothes are put away. If Eli had a refrigerator in here, he might never have to come out of this room. Eli walks to the computer table and flips the switch on his Commodore 128. The machine whirs to life. Mark loves to explain, and Paul and Eli crowd around him at the monitor. As they log into the Laurelton switch to start exploring, he describes every command they're typing, even the commands they already know, in precise, easy-to-understand language. He knows everything, and Mark is just as excited by this session as they are, because he senses that finally he's met two other hackers who can ride at his pace. For his part, Mark will always think of this evening as a meeting of the minds. They forgot who they were and where they were, and thought only about where they were headed. Mark has shown them how to use the 9X packet switch network to jump off into other switches as well, and tonight they traipse around in the Hollis switch system for a while. In earlier phone conversations, Mark has told them different ways he's found to get into phone company computers, and Paul took it all in. So tonight, Mark never has to repeat a phone number, never has to explain the meaning of a command to Paul. Mark types it, and Paul absorbs it. Because the progression of commands on the monitor is distinctly logical, Paul watches just once, and the new numbers are committed to memory. An hour later, when the three boys want to return to the computer they'd said goodbye to, Paul is at the keyboard and competently types in the commands again. No misses, no questions. Imagine the feeling. Every pathetic BBS is filled with files on how to crack this computer system and how to crack that one. Anyone but a moron knows that it's baloney, a farce, techno-silliness that doesn't work. Any kid with a modem talks about hacking the phone system in the same way that any teenager talks about getting laid. In other words, it happens, but rarely, and usually to someone else. But now, here they are, typing on a piece of $300 equipment, hooked into what seems like one of the mightiest computers in the world. For someone else, it might have all sorts of catastrophic appeal. You could do anything, even cut off phone service to the whole Laurelton neighborhood. But that's anathema to them. They'd no sooner crash a computer system than they would cut off a finger. That's what they tell each other. They believe in the hacker ethic. Thou shalt not destroy. It's okay to look around, but don't hurt anything. It's good enough just to be here. It's late now. The mission is turned into an all-nighter. And it's the bold hour when all the authority figures they've ever known are already asleep, oblivious to the escalation of the shared kinetic energy in this room. They log into one of New York Telephone's Cosmos computers, whose intricacies Mark is happy to explain. Cosmos is a grand-sounding acronym that turns up on any self-respecting hacker BBS. File after file is written about it, as if the system with the fancy name was somehow the very key to the Bell system. It's all nonsense, explains Mark. Cosmos, he says, stands for Computer System for Mainframe Operations, and is nothing more than a giant database of work orders. It's an operation system that phone company employees use when they have to change something on a phone line. Cosmos has a directory of customer phone numbers, archives that list the number of the cable and pair that run from the big silver box on the telephone pole outside and into your house. You can look up anybody's phone service on Cosmos. Just read the code line for somebody's service, and you suddenly know such intimate details as whether the customer has three-way calling, or call waiting, or call forwarding. That's what it is, Mark explains. Nothing to it. Mark shows them how to call up actual service orders for the phone lines that lead into each of their own houses. It's so exciting seeing it there on screen. They're doing this with a laughably slow modem, a modem that pumps data at the rate of 1,200 bits of data per second. It takes forever for the screen to refresh itself at that rate. But it's oh so sweet when it happens. They see Eli's own phone number. They see the features he has on his phone. The boys have an uncontrollable urge to crow, to scrawl graffiti across this privileged line of computer code as it blinks on the screen. If any one of the boys were hacking alone in his bedroom, he wouldn't feel the same way. But here they are, together, and they need to mark their shared journey. Thou shalt not destroy. No, of course not. But they traveled here. This is their turf, and they want to plant a flag. That wouldn't be destroying anything, would it? And Cosmos is inviting them to do just that with this tantalizing prompt, J.A. percentage. So they decide to write Eli's hacker handle on his phone line. Right there, right on the computer. Just write it in. They know the commands to type. Mark was the first to figure them out. They tell the computer to execute a service order. J.A. percentage. S.O.E. Then they tell the computer that the service order will modify service on Eli's phone number. Let's say his number is 555-9365. Underscore I. T.N. equals 555-9365. Then they tell the computer to execute the order on the next day. Underscore H. O.R.D. equals C1AP 1234, comma OT equals CH, comma DD equals 071389, FFD equals 071389. Then they tell the computer to add remarks to Eli's phone number. Underscore I, RMKT equals acid freak. That's the end of the service order, they tell the computer. Underscore E. It's dizzying, the risk. Because what if some phone company employee calls it up the next day and sees acid freak written into the code? On the other hand, why would anyone call it up ever? Unless the Lidopoulos family requests a change in service. The boys leave it. They aren't hurting anything. They write fiber optic on Mark's phone line. They leave it that way. By the time Eli drives them home, in the late, late part of a night that's ready to become morning, they are talking about what they'll do when they log in again in a few hours. There are so many places to go, so many things to learn.
Is it possible to listen in on ongoing phone conversations? Is there a way to get into the phone company's automated message accounting, which contains billing information and lists the phone numbers that a certain number calls? By the time the night ends, all three know one thing. They can't wait to get together again. There's a big street map of Queens on one wall in Eli's room. From the East River to Long Island, the map details the hundreds and hundreds of crisscrossing streets and avenues and boulevards and highways that cut up the borough. It identifies the parks, the airports, and the jail at Rikers Island. Stand in front of the map and trace the grid with a finger, and you could see how Eli's house was the natural hub. It was smack in the center of all of Queens, with Mark's red brick house at the end of a spoke on the northwest and Paul's frame house at the end of another spoke that stretches southeast. Not only is Eli's house positioned perfectly for a command center, but his Commodore 128 was more powerful than the computers that Mark and Paul owned. Mark never went to Paul's house, except once to drop him off, and then he certainly never set foot inside. Paul sometimes went to Mark's house, but there was usually nothing good to eat. Mark wasn't interested in snacks, so he didn't offer any. One time, Paul and Hack brought their own dinner, lasagna and foil, and they ate on Mark's front stoop, just to make a point. A lot of times the guys got together at the Queens Mall, where Paul liked his coffee sweet, and Mark liked to get mashed potatoes from the Kentucky Fried Chicken outlet. He was queasy a lot, stuck to bland food, and rarely ate before the afternoon. It was just part of who he is. The problem with real mashed potatoes is that people make them lumpy. But he could eat several portions of those reconstituted, processed, starchy ones at the mall. Go figure. But how often could you go to the mall? There was no computer there. So Eli's house, Eli's bedroom, that was the place. It was the closest thing to a clubhouse that they'd ever have. Four or five guys could hang out comfortably in that room. On the bed, on the chair, on the floor, on the computer, drinking caffeine in any of its splendid forms, running the modem off the phone line while keeping the second line free for voice calls. They were learning a lot about the phone system, from the inside. If Eli called it the mission, Mark thought of it as the project. And Paul? He just wanted to know more. Even when they were at home, hacking on their respective computers, they kept in contact, phoning two or three times a day, updating each other on what they were finding in phone company computers. What does this command do? What does this acronym mean? Often, though, they ended up working together, at least by evening. They knew so much now, collectively, so much more than they did on their own. But nobody knew they knew. It was frustrating being so omnipotent. Imagine being able to fly. Imagine being invisible. And now imagine not being able to tell anyone about it. Then one night, about 8 o'clock, they got an idea. The three of them were hanging in Eli's room, looking at the map of Queens on the wall, and realized there was at least one place in the borough that the three of them could fly to. It was called Anarchy. It was a virtual neighborhood, actually. This computer bulletin board called Anarchy. Some kid ran it from his bedroom in Outer Queens, as Mark calls it. The boys in Eli's room had some unfinished business with Anarchy. Paul had discovered the phone number for the Anarchy board once when he was on a different board. Just for the fun of it, Paul had even signed up as a user on the board, which had a special section for posting files specific to hacking and freaking, hacking the phone system. And one time when Paul was at Eli's, they had all logged in to take a quick tour of the hack freak archives. The files were garbage. One file said that Cosmos ran the whole phone system. Another example, a bunch of files blathered about remobs, the actual physical units that attached a pair of phone cables to allow remote access. Well, the lamers on Anarchy bought into this stupid misconception that if you possessed some magic phone number, you could dial it to access remobs. Then key in a 3-digit code and someone else's phone number and eavesdrop on conversations. That might have been true in a parallel universe, but in the Bell system, please. The boys in Eli's room had tried to set things straight, posting a correction on Anarchy. You're wrong. But that just started a flame war, with all the board's users joining in to defend the status quo. It was a pushing and shoving match, a schoolyard brawl that the boys in Eli's room had never really forgotten. The kid who ran Anarchy called himself the graduate. He was the kind of puffed-up wannabe that Mark calls a larva hacker. A kid who says, "I specialize in networks," as if he really knows the first thing about networks. It burned, if you want to know the truth. Here were Mark, Paul, and Eli putting in the hours, doing the real work, truly figuring out how the system works. Then along came some kid like the graduate, some poser type, who knew nothing, and the kid was spewing online, beating his chest, and giving everyone a headache.
What could you do about it? Actually, the boys could do a lot, knowing what they did now. So it happened that the Anarchy phone number was archived on a switch that the boys in Eli's room could control. Maybe what happened next was inevitable. Maybe not. But one thing was for sure. There was no turning back. "Let's take over Anarchy," someone said. Maybe there was a split second when one of them could have demurred. Probably not. And besides, no one did. A group mind had already taken over. Something bigger than all of them had been born. The first phone call the boys make in their scheme to overthrow Anarchy is to a company. We'll call it Phone Box, that operates a voicemail system in Manhattan. This is how Phone Box does business. It rents out voicemail boxes, which are kind of like post office boxes for phone messages. Phone Box has dozens of phone lines assigned to it, which customers rent. The customer's business associates and friends can then leave messages in the voicemail box. All of the numbers that Phone Box rents to customers begin with the Manhattan area code 212, followed by the prefix 333. The last four digits, the extension, are unique to each customer. Places like Phone Box promise customers anonymity and therefore attract a certain clientele. There's an odor about the place that hackers find irresistible, like a carnival midway where all sorts of sleazy transactions are consummated in the back alleys. The boys in Eli's room could hack a customer's line. The default password is the same as the last four digits of the phone number, or sometimes there'd be no password at all. Smart. And listen to private messages. They would hear nameless voices leave what sounded like stolen calling card numbers. It takes the boys in Eli's room no time to set up their own voicemail box on a vacant line in the phone box system. They record a genial greeting on the phone box answering machine. Next, they log into the phone company switch on which the graduate is a customer. On the screen, they call up the phone number for the Anarchy bulletin board and add a feature to its phone service, call forwarding. Then they forward all the bulletin board's calls to the answering machine on the phone box line. It's a fine hack. Now, any kid who tries to log into Anarchy will unknowingly bypass the bulletin board. The phone call will be routed automatically to the phone box voicemail box, where a voice will greet the caller with this message. "Hi, this is the graduate. The board crashed, and I lost all the files. If you want to keep your account, leave your login and your password now, and we'll set it up for you as soon as the system is up again." The message will pipe through a little speaker on the computer. "Pick up the phone and leave your password now." Beautiful. Of course, the calls come streaming in one after another, and every caller leaves a message. Nobody can get through to the real Anarchy board, which sits dormant, as neglected as an unplugged vending machine. Everything's cool. The boys are culling all the logins and passwords they could possibly want, listening to each voice message and laughing uproariously as the callers leave their private information on the machine. The boys are hacking hackers. Then one of the messages on the voicemail box gets their attention. The message has a different tone to it. Worried. Confused. Something's wrong. The caller isn't your everyday lame hacker, no. He's the co-system operator for the whole Anarchy bulletin board. He's the graduate's best friend, the only one entrusted with running the system when the graduate is out of town, which turns out he is, visiting his grandmother in New Jersey. The co-system operator must believe that the system really crashed and that the graduate is trying to patch it back together, because he leaves his login and password. Too funny. Doesn't even pick up on the fact that the voice claiming to be the graduate is an imposter. But hey, that's voicemail for you. The boys in Eli's room decide to bypass the voicemail box now. They're having such a good time. They change the call forwarding instructions so that the calls are forwarded directly to Eli's house. Eli's answering the phone himself, live, taking down everybody's login and password, and the calls keep coming in over the white cordless phone. But then the co-system operator calls back. It must have really rankled him, or maybe just seemed strange, because he's on the line again. And you can tell he's suspicious. He hangs up. The phone rings almost immediately. Paul answers this time. He starts to say, "Hello, this is the graduate." But then the caller breaks in. "I'm the graduate," the caller says. It is the graduate himself, no lie, calling from New Jersey, trying to figure out what went wrong with his bulletin board. The co-system operator had given him a heads up, but the graduate thinks he's calling a phone line that leads to his own bedroom. That's the number he dialed, and he has no idea that anyone has forwarded the number to another location. So what the graduate thinks is, who's standing in my bedroom, in outer Queens, rifling through my disks, and my notebooks, and my hard drive, and who knows, even my underwear drawer? "Who is this?" the graduate demands from New Jersey. "What are you doing in my house?" Paul, whose strengths do not lie in verbal volleying,
shoots the phone over to Eli. Without missing a beat, Eli says into the receiver, using a deadly serious voice, "We are the Secret Service Special Task Force, and we're taking away all your computer equipment." My, my, my. You can practically hear the thud when the graduate's heart falls right on Granny's rug. Because as every teenage hacker in America knows, this is how a promising young man gets cut down in the prime of his underground BBS life. The Secret Service busts you. It's well known that the service handles investigation of electronic intrusions, and every hacker in America fancies himself a clever intruder. The graduate is no exception to this conceit, and, all the laughing in the background of Eli's end of the conversation notwithstanding, the graduate does what any kid would do, confronted with a dreadful certainty that the jig finally is up. He panics. He's been raided. He's headed to jail, where he will be forced, no doubt, to be another man's wife. Worse, what will his parents say? "You're in a lot of trouble," Eli says. "I didn't do anything wrong," the graduate yells, but not convincingly. "What do you want?" The graduate will do anything to make this agony end. There's a hitch in his voice. He's near hysteria. "We're packing up your stuff, and your parents aren't going to like this," Eli says. "Don't worry. We'll call you." The boys are listening in, and somebody yells, "Hey, let's see what's in his refrigerator while we're here." But apparently the graduate doesn't hear that part. Or if he does, he assumed that the refrigerator searches are standard procedure, because he says, "Okay, okay, okay." And then, just like that, he volunteers his own login and his own password, which is, believe it or not, Supra, like Eli's car. Since the graduate is the system operator, his password gives the boys in Eli's room the power to do anything they want with his bulletin board. Change things, rewrite programs, delete files, you name it. After they hang up, the boys in Eli's room start to pack up. They erase the message on the voicemail box. They erase the call forwarding command on the graduate's phone line. And they also give Anarchy a new phone number that hasn't been assigned to another New York telephone customer. 718-555-0000. That's to keep anyone from calling and tying up the line. Then Eli calls the new phone number, types Supra, and starts looking around in the guts of the Anarchy system. The boys are looking over his shoulder, shouting suggestions, having a good time when something happens. Plick. P-L-I-K. This weird word appears on Eli's monitor. If it's an acronym, even Mark has never heard of it. Plick. Eli tries to type something and hits return. But the Anarchy system is not responding to commands. Who knows why? Plick. Eli is pounding the keyboard, but nothing happens. It's a disaster. He breaks the connection, calls back again. This time the Anarchy system is not responding at all. It's acting just plain dead. Who knows why? A disaster. Paul says, "Damn, it crashed." Nobody ever heard from the graduate again. He never posted another message on a bulletin board, at least not a message that any of the boys in Eli's room had heard of. About a week or so after Anarchy went down, Paul tried calling the board's phone number, and it was disconnected. "The number you are trying to reach is no longer in service," the phone company caddish. Paul wondered if the graduate ever told his parents what happened, or if he waited in fear for the Secret Service to return. The other boys didn't mention the incident, didn't talk about how whatever they did that day got away from them. It was an odd experience, crashing something, even a lamer board. Never would any of the three of them have harmed the system intentionally. Never would any of them have violated the hacker ethic by destroying anything. They only mentioned the experience obliquely after that. Whenever something struck them as weird and inexplicable, this is what they would say. Plick. The summer had turned out to be a great one. By the time August rolled around, Paul, Mark, and Eli felt as if they'd known each other forever. They'd learned a lot, and there was more to learn one night in August when the New York Telephone Company's employees walked off the job to form strike lines. At midnight, New York Telephone Management changed the network password to connect to Cosmos to protect the system from disgruntled workers. Now, in the middle of a session, Paul, Eli, and Mark were suddenly locked out. How dare they? At 12:20 a.m., the phone company's technical assistance center got a call. "Hi, I'm a craft worker, and I'm trying to finish this job, see? And you changed the password on me." The manager who answered the phone had to admire the worker's dedication. "We're not going to let a little thing like a strike get in the way of customer service. Stay on the job. Stay on the job." the thankful manager said. Here's the password. Y6NEQ2. By 12:21 a.m., the boys were back in business. They were on a roll. They couldn't be stopped. They were all powerful. Where were they headed? Where would it end? It didn't matter, because they were going together. 4. Plick, indeed. Now, if Tom Kaiser could have seen the kind of activity that the boys in Eli's room were engaged in during the summer of 1989, the events that were to follow, that changed all of their lives, might never have occurred. But Kaiser couldn't see through walls. As a lawman on the electronic frontier, Kaiser did have some unusual powers, to be sure. He could attach one of those black boxes, a Hakimian dial number recorder, DNR, to your phone. He could keep track of every call you made, every number you dialed, every time you lifted the receiver off the hook. But Tom Kaiser was not a magician. The security specialist for New York Telephone had no way of knowing the identities of the trespassers he tracked through the labyrinthine confines of the phone company's privately owned, privately operated computers. To him, all the criminals who broke into his computers were equal. All he could do was follow their footprints, and all the footprints were the same size. Kaiser was not a policeman in the traditional sense. He didn't carry a gun or handcuffs, nor did he have the power to arrest anyone. But he was responsible for maintaining order across all the millions of miles of phone lines that New York Telephone owns. He patrolled the busiest beat in America, because it was his job to keep the peace on that last mile where twisted copper wires connect every home and business in New York to the rest of the world. If you broke into New York Telephone's system, it was Tom Kaiser's job to track you and stop you, and he would. On this morning in 1989, Kaiser arrived early at his 23rd floor office in New York Telephone's headquarters building, smack in the center of one of Midtown Manhattan's most spectacular intersections, 42nd Street and 6th Avenue. He glances out the window at the river or traffic that cuts up north toward Central Park and then logs onto his computer. Kaiser doesn't waste time. He wants to see what his hacker was up to last night. Columns of numbers fill Kaiser's screen, a record of all the phone calls that a certain young man in the Bronx, known as the Technician, made during the past 12 hours. Many of the numbers are familiar to Kaiser by now and are harmless. But one of his chores is to chase down the numbers he doesn't recognize. This morning, he sees one. By its prefix, he knows it's an internal New York Telephone number. Quickly, he punches it into another database, which lists every assigned telephone number in the New York region. The screen flashes. New York Telephone Company. Dial Hub. The words Dial Hub mean nothing to him. He calls the number, and a modem answers. This is definitely not good. Luckily, one person in the world who can tell Kaiser how bad the situation is has just arrived at his office. Kaiser calls him. Hey, Fred, Kaiser says to his partner. The hacker has hit a new number. He reads it off, then asks, what's a dial hub? Fred Staples is incredulous. They were in our dial hub? Yeah, what's a dial hub? Ah, shit, says Staples. What? How long was the call? Asks Staples. About a half hour. Ah, shit. For Tom Kaiser, the whole message started with an anonymous letter he got by way of AT&T. Somebody had sent the long-distance carrier a single sheet of computer printout paper. Just a couple of paragraphs, no date. The letter was sent a few months ago, back in November of 1988. The letter said some kid in the Bronx, the Technician, was getting himself into trouble, hacking into telco switches and God knows what else. Kaiser had a lot of anonymous letters. Usually these turned out to be from some landlord who wanted to use a pending phone company investigation as an excuse to evict a tenant. This letter, though, had been sent by someone who clearly cared for the kid in the Bronx. It was a stop-him-before-he-hurts-himself tone. Kaiser would always suspect it had been written by a relative. The first thing he'd done when he got the letter, the first thing he always did, was to pick up the subject's billing records. And he got a surprise. The kid was calling AT&T switches from his home, making no attempt to disguise his trespass. Up went the DNR on the kid's phone line. The black box was no bigger than an old-fashioned adding machine. It spewed out old-fashioned paper tape, too, making a reassuring clack-clacking sound all day and all night long. An old-fashioned machine to catch newfangled criminals. Over the years, Kaiser had become familiar with the noise. He could hear it from across the hall, and whenever he was on a particularly hot case, a hostage standoff, say, he would bolt from his seat at the sound of it. It was the same kind of device police agencies use in drug investigations. Unlike the police, however, phone companies don't need a court order to install a DNR on someone's line. That's because the phone company owns the line, and by federal statute, has the right to monitor its property. AT&T's problem with the Bronx hacker had become New York Telephone's problem in early 1989, because one morning when Kaiser was reviewing the night's activity, he found that the Bronx kid had called New York Telephone computers. Now this was something new. Kaiser knew all about toll fraud, of course, because for years he had been tracking people who stole phone calling card numbers. But in 1989, it was a relatively infrequent phenomenon to have people breaking into the phone company's computers. Kaiser had never before needed to become an expert in the internal workings of the phone company's own system, so he needed someone who was an expert. Coincidence saved him. Kaiser was the first to point out that coincidence had long played a serendipitous role in his career. The day Kaiser needed to know about New York Telephone's own system, so it happened that an expert named Fred Staples was in the office. Staples was replacing the old clack-clacking DNRs with new equipment, computer DNRs to track computer criminals. Nobody knew more about the phone company's computer security than Staples. They didn't know it then, but with this hacker case, Kaiser and Staples were going to be in each other's faces for the next few months, like a middle-aged married couple, though they looked more like the odd couple. Kaiser is tall and thin and silver-haired, and Staples is shorter, dark-haired, and built like a pit bull. Kaiser's eyes smile and welcome you, reflecting his early years spent in customer service. Staples' eyes bore into you and analyze. Staples was an engineer and spent all his time building hardware and software for the phone company. He was New York Telephone's main defense against hackers, and it was his job to make sure that what he built was secure. If an unauthorized user broke into the system, Staples took it personally. It was his system. Kaiser and Staples soon noticed an unusual pattern in the phone calls the technician made from his Bronx home. First, the hacker would call a phone company computer, stay connected for 10 or 15 minutes, then log out. Next, he would call a certain phone number in Queens. Then he would call back the computer for 10 or 15 minutes, then the number in Queens, then the computer, then Queens. They pulled the billing records on the Queens number and learned that it was assigned to the residence of Charles Abeen. Kaiser and Staples concluded that someone at the Abeen residence must be coaching the technician. Whenever the Bronx hacker got stuck in the phone company computer, he'd log out and call the Abeen residence for assistance, then try the computer again, all night long. Kaiser got the chill. He was familiar with the part of Queens where the Abeens live, a neighborhood near Roosevelt Avenue in Jackson Heights. Law enforcement agencies often presented the phone company with court orders for DNRs and wiretaps on the phones of suspected drug dealers in that neighborhood. Kaiser had no idea who was on the phone at the Abeen residence. He had no idea it was a skinny kid with a dog-eared copy of The Hobbit on his bookshelf. For all Kaiser knew, it could have been some narco-terrorist from the Cali cartel who had the run of New York Telephone's internal phone system. They could knock out phone service to the entire Northeast if they knew what they were doing. And imagine what they could do if they didn't know what they were doing. So the technician had gotten into the dial hub, probably with the help of his friend, Abeen. A dial hub is supposed to be one of the most secure entry points in the whole New York Telephone computer system. In 1989, it was a brand new technology that the phone company was installing, so new that its name, at least, was unknown to most of the people who worked for the phone company. The hub was a way to keep intruders out of the system, even as authorized employees could connect from home. It was the first line of defense, and you could only get in if you knew the right 10-digit password. Every single one of New York Telephone's thousands of employees had a personalized 10-digit number. Once you got into the dial hub, it became simply a subway system that you could ride to any destination within the New York Telephone Company system. Technically, the hub was a pool of modems. The modems were like trains, waiting for passengers to board them. Next stop, Mizar. All aboard for Premlac. Cosmos, last stop. If someone without a token tried to board, the dial hub would disconnect the unauthorized user. During the night, the technician had gotten hold of a token. And for half an hour, who knew where he'd ridden? At each stop, you needed another password to enter a specific system. But the DNR had no way of tracking the rider once he passed through the dial hub's turnstile. Kaiser asked Staples what the hacker could have been looking for. Staples didn't want to consider the possibilities, but he had to. I don't think there's any computer worth mentioning that we own that's not accessible through there. What were some of the stops on the subway? Computers that were used to provision new services. Computers that were used to maintain phone company buildings and plants. Computers that detailed work schedules for every employee and every job. And that was just the administrative stuff. Beyond that, the hackers could enter every switch in the New York Telephone region. Staples hung up the phone in his office two blocks north whereas Window faced Kaiser's. They could have waved to each other if they'd thought of it. They never had. Staples came right over to Kaiser's office, and within an hour, he and Kaiser met with Kaiser's boss. They laid out the whole thing. We think we may have something big here. It's something bigger and broader than anything we've encountered before. This is the moment when the case transformed itself. The day before, it had been a case like others in the past. A case of one intruder. A case where only one switch, one isolated point in the network, was hit. Today, at least two interlopers were involved, and they could be anywhere in the system. The number of perpetrators had doubled overnight, causing the case to grow geometrically. Today, the lawmen were fighting a network of intruders. Today, they were fighting a conspiracy. Kaiser's boss agreed. It was time to broaden the investigation. Up went another DNR, this time on Abeen's phone. Staples told Kaiser how to watch over the hacker's shoulders, even after the DNR lost track of them in the system. Staples told Kaiser which administrators were responsible for monitoring the breached computers, and how to notify the administrators each time the hackers log in. The administrators often could reconstruct, from their audit logs, all the commands that the hackers used to move around the system. That way, if the worst should happen, someone would be able to work backward to fix the problem. When New York Telephone's union employees went on strike in August, Staples' strike assignment was to move down to the desk next to Kaiser's. It was close quarters in Kaiser's office, which, except for the spectacular view, looked perfectly ordinary with its Max Headroom coffee mug and standard-issue bookshelves spilling arcane technical manuals, just like any other sugar cube of a workspace in Midtown Manhattan. With all the high-tech activity, you'd expect to see something like the War Room of the National Security Council. You'd expect to see something with more bells and whistles than Kaiser's ancient black computer terminal, so clunky it could have been manufactured in Russia. The walls of the office were dirty white, or maybe clean gray. Two battered metal desks sat in a space so tight that their edges almost touched. A space that, come to think of it, wasn't any bigger than Mark Abeen's bedroom. But it was the antithesis of Mark's bedroom. Kaiser and Staples got along well. Both were lifelong members of the phone company family. Workers who got their first entry-level job with New York Telephone in the late 1960s, back when the phone company was expanding every day and career opportunities seemed limitless. Back then, AT&T owned the whole phone system, including New York Telephone, and it was easy to get a job. Kaiser was one of the first males hired to handle customer complaints in AT&T's downtown office at 195 Broadway. He worked his way up to management, and in the 1980s was transferred first to the regulatory department, which dealt with company-wide complaints, and then to the toll fraud department. As a young man, Staples had worked as a stagehand, fitting together pieces of scenery like so many pieces of a puzzle. He had always liked to build, had always seen the world as being divided into units that could be assembled. The phone company hired him as a communications serviceman in the late 1960s, when rapid expansion had overwhelmed AT&T's mechanical capabilities. Customers complained about bad service. Staples learned to repair teletype machines. As the phone system changed and grew, so did Staples. Around the same time that the boys in Eli's room were crashing the anarchy system, the DNRs were leading Kaiser and Staples to two more phone lines. By now, the pattern was familiar. By now, it was not such a shock to learn that there was a whole group of trespassers out there. By now, the lawmen had gotten used to the word. Conspiracy. The two new phone numbers were the ones that Abeen dialed frequently, repeatedly, in between calls to phone company computers. So now the black box watched the lines of Elias Lidopoulos and Mrs. Jean Styra as well. You wouldn't believe the stuff that was turning up on the morning logs. Dial hubs were the least of it. The technician had turned into small fry, bait to catch bigger fish. Kaiser and Staples feared they might be dealing with a widespread threat to their network securities, that there was nowhere the hackers couldn't and wouldn't go. During the strike, Kaiser and Staples worked 18 hours a day, 7 days a week on the hacker case. Staples sat by the window, chain-smoking Marlboros, trying to get inside the hackers' heads. The situation was quite impossible. The hackers were probably kids, just like the technician, but maybe not. Maybe they were drug dealers. Should Kaiser and Staples shut down the hackers now? Just block their access to the phone computers? Of course, if they did that, they wouldn't know how far the intruders had gotten, nor what they were after. But if Kaiser and Staples allowed the hackers to continue, couldn't some awful consequence result? What if the hackers crashed a system? It was kind of like having a tarantula crawl up your leg. If you shook it off too fast, it would escape into the wall. But if you waited too long, you got bitten. They wanted help from law enforcement. They wanted to send a message that hacking the phone system was not the touchy-feely thing it was back in the 1960s, when Joe Hacker would get a friendly wake-up call from the phone company. a polite warning. Too much was at stake now. You hit the wrong key, and oops, there went the phone service to Wall Street. Kaiser and Staples knew that unless you could show that the intrusions had caused at least $1,000 worth of damage or loss of service, they wouldn't get the U.S. Attorney's Office interested. And it was important to prosecute. If the hackers were kids, it was still a good idea to send a message. Scare them. Come down on them with the full, heavy weight of the law. Kids wouldn't end up in jail for this kind of bravado trespassing, they figured. Hell, they had kids of their own. But the hackers would learn their limits if they got a stern lecture from a judge, coupled with a couple hundred hours of community service. Since 1987, the phone company had, in fact, snared other teenagers snooping around in the phone system. Kids with names like Bill from RNOC and Delta Master and Ninja NYC. Those cases, involving juveniles under the age of 18, were disposed of quietly, sometimes with only a phone call to a parent. That's what happens if you're dealing with kids. That is, if you know for sure you're dealing with kids. Staples spouts a blue stream of Marlboro smoke, considering the options. With Staples in the office, the smoke gets so thick it reaches down to the floor. The room was in a haze. Months from now, Kaiser would move a picture from the wall and see the darkened outline of the frame's original position. Staples smokes so much that it gets into the paint. One option is going to the media. Going public, but the fact that it is nearly impossible to fool around undetected in the phone company computers. Announce the intrusions, and at the same time show how the system has been secured. Another possibility, assuming the hackers were all kids, is creating an educational program to channel some of this misdirected energy. The phone company, after all, has a hard enough time finding qualified people to train as telecommunications engineers. But that's academic, and this is the real world. The facts for Kaiser and Staple are these. We don't know who we are dealing with, and we are witnessing a more dangerous level of infiltration than ever before. In the end, they realize there is only one option. Kaiser awakens early one morning and thinks, today could be the day that we nab the hackers. He already feels the summer heat through his shirt as he leaves his house on Long Island to make an early train to Manhattan. This morning he will have to convince more literal-minded lawmen that crimes committed on computers are as much their concern as the drug buys on 42nd Street. Today Kaiser has reserved the big conference room, and the meeting is full of phone company people, and the investigators from New York City's Police Department's Special Frauds Unit and the U.S. Secret Service. Knowing that the technical aspect of the case might make it difficult for non-technicians to grasp, Kaiser and Staples explained the case in general terms. We may be coming to you with this case we have, and how should we do that? Kaiser says. What have you got? Asks one of the investigators. We have three hackers, Kaiser says. Staples gives it a shot and talks about how the phone company switches are being targeted. He talks about the dial hubs and about how it would be relatively easy for New York Telephone to simply close the holes in the system to lock out these particular hackers. But the problem is bigger than that, he says. If the hackers could get into New York Telephone's computers, they might be able to get into the phone system in other regions as well. The problem is national, Staples says. The investigators are taking all this in, nodding, jotting down notes.
Somebody says Staples and Kaiser should meet soon with the U.S. Attorney's Office. A Secret Service agent says he will report this to his supervisors. Staples and Kaiser are feeling pretty good, like they got the message across and everyone in the room understands the magnitude of the problem. Then one of the investigators raises his hand. All of the New York Telephone Company people look at him. What's a switch? He asks. It was autumn now, and the heat of the city summer seemed to have been absorbed by the people walking the picket line that Kaiser had to cross to reach the revolving glass doors of his skyscraper. Crossing the picket line really doesn't bother Kaiser. Sometimes they threw eggs. But in his teens, Kaiser was a teamster. He could handle a few eggs from the Communication Workers of America. One day in October, late in the afternoon, the black box had told Kaiser that someone from the Lidopolis residence had just placed a call to New York Telephone's business office, right under his very nose, and it was still in progress. What were the hackers after now? It was a long phone call. Kaiser thought the connection would last forever. The minutes were just ticking by, and he was dying to find out who the hackers were calling at his shop. Finally, the DNR told him the connection was broken. Immediately, Kaiser punched the digits to connect him with the same number at the business office. The employee who answered the phone was an old supervisor of Kaiser's, from the days when he worked in the business office. Normally, she wouldn't be answering the phone at all, not when Kaiser calls and not when a hacker phones. But her strike duty was to take field calls that came to the business office. Who was that on the phone? Kaiser asked her. Some poor plant guy who stuck up on a pole, she said. She was surprised that Kaiser was calling and that there was a problem with what seemed like such a routine request.
Kaiser winced when she explained that the caller said he was a repair technician named John Gilmore, who needed a phone number transferred from New York to New Jersey. Of course she'd put through the work order. The request was perfectly ordinary. Kaiser recognized the name John Gilmore. Gilmore was a former hacker who went on to become a millionaire writing code at Sun Microsystems. Kaiser quickly countermanded the work order. Every day was an exercise in frustration. It seemed like the case would drag on forever, and all Kaiser and Staples could do was run around putting out fires. By the end of the summer, they thought they had accumulated enough evidence, and they finally met with an assistant U.S. attorney right after Labor Day. They went downtown to his office, scrupulously prepared for the meeting, organizing all the information that they had collected about unauthorized intrusions in the notebooks with neat colored tabs. They had charts, too. The prosecutors told them that the office was definitely interested. Just keep accumulating evidence. More meetings followed. Uptown, downtown, in Brooklyn, where the Eastern District of the U.S. Attorney's Office is headquartered. Meetings with the Secret Service near Wall Street. Meetings with the police. The tarantula was still creeping. Just sitting there, forced to watch the hackers logging into their computers, was starting to drive Kaiser and Staples a little crazy. They decided to go undercover in cyberspace. The only disguises they needed were anonymous computer handles. They had some phone numbers for so-called underground bulletin boards. So they called one named Shadow World. They logged right in, just like hackers would. They used the handles Splinter and Rapier. They felt a little silly doing it, being grown men and all, but at the same time, it was useful. They cruised the files. They got a real sense of the kind of information that your run-of-the-mill wannabe hacker possessed. Kaiser said, "It increases our level of knowledge." They feel like spies, reading files and looking for clues that the hacker intrusions might be more widespread than anyone suspects. Who's to say this case is limited to just three hackers? Who's to say it's limited to phone company computers in the New York area? Evidence of a broader problem might interest the U.S. Attorney's Office, they figure. Then one day they're in the prosecutor's office, explaining the case again. Some of the faces are old, some of the faces are new. It seems clear to everyone that the three hackers have repeatedly entered phone company computers. It seems clear that the evidence is irrefutable. Kaiser and Staples are ready for a sign, ready for search warrants, ready to put an end to the damn thing. And someone raises a hand and asks, "What's a switch?" 5. Sometimes you just have to blurt out the news, not even try to cushion the impact. When the whole world shifts and heaves, you just have to come out and say what happened. Mark got kicked out of the Legion of Doom. There it is. In all its horrible bluntness, he's kicked out. He's gone. He's unplugged. Word of his expulsion leaks out, all over the underground. How did it happen? Some kind of fight. Who knows? But it's posted on bulletin boards from here to Germany. It's the talk of the hacker elite. Fiber Optic got into a feud with Eric Bloodaxe, and to hear Eric Bloodaxe tell it, Fiber Optic lost. Here's how it happened. One day in 1989, while Chris was working on his big hacker project, a directory of computers on a large data network known as Telnet, the phone rings. The caller is LOD member Mark Abe, up in New York City. Mark is really upset. His account on the 9X packet switch network was killed. Can you imagine? Fiber Optic without access to the 9X packet switch network? It was like James Dean without a motorcycle. Mark desperately wants to get back in the system and knows that Chris has a secret route to the computer. Mark asks for it. Now, Chris knows Mark has access to a list of addresses of certain phone company computers that you can reach over Telnet. Chris wants to include those addresses in his directory. "Why don't you just go on there and get that and give me that list?" Chris asks Mark. Chris is calling the shots after all. "I can't do that right now, but you can just go do it yourself," Mark says, giving Chris an account name to get the list. When Chris tries, the account doesn't work. "All right, I'll try to find another one," Mark says. But now for the outrageous part, the part that will make Chris sputter with rage even years later. After they hang up, Mark calls Bob, a hacker friend of Chris's, who lives in Massachusetts. And Mark asks Bob for the secret route. Chris says it's okay, Mark convinces him. Bob calls Chris later that day and says, "Well, Mark called up and I gave him the information." "You did what?" "He said you said it was all right. He was really convincing." "Did he give you the account?" Chris asks. "No, he said he was going to give it to you later." Chris is totally furious. Right away, he gets Mark on the phone. "Mark, what are you doing calling Bob and telling lies to get that route? Give me the account like you promised. I need that list." "I don't know you shit," There it is again. That New York attitude. Excuse me? I don't owe you shit. I didn't get it from you. I got it from Bob. Fuck you. What? Chris says. No, man, I don't have time for this, Mark says, hanging up the phone on Eric Bloodaxe. Well, you can imagine how mad Chris was. He calls every single member of the Legion of Doom and tells them what went down. One by one, he gets their votes. Mark is out. 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 You don't screw people like that, Chris says. Of course, Mark told his own version. His version rambled a little. Let's see. From Mark's perspective, the name Legion of Doom had outlived its reputation. He was so far ahead of what anyone in the gang knew that it was ridiculous. LOD had its own bulletin boards, of course, which only members could visit. Catch-22, the first LOD board that Mark logged onto, was just one of many. You also got access to Plovernet. But plenty of good boards weren't controlled by LOD. Sherwood Forest, which actually was located in Forest Hills, Queens, was run by a kid who called himself Magnetic Surfer. Mark told people he got bored with LOD. In his opinion, the text files on its boards were moronic, supposedly instructing you in how to hack Cosmos, how to hack a Unix computer. Utter silliness, in Mark's opinion, written by pretenders who knew so little about their subjects that they listed incorrect commands, wrong descriptions. Who wanted to be associated with that? Did Mark actually say he quit? Well, in Mark's version of the story, yes, there was this guy, and yes, his name was Chris Goggins.